Hello and welcome, dear listeners, to the third episode of Reject and Resubmit. As always, we are
Philip,
Marco,
and myself, Alexander, broadcasting to you from Switzerland, probably or definitely for the last time. I have not managed to accumulate at least 500,000 francs on my account and thus will be banished from this country forever. To get us started and get you a bit more acquainted with the hosts, we have abandoned the quiz show intro for a less intellectually challenging exercise. And I myself have fallen into a bit of a rabbit hole on around handheld gaming consoles, which led to a brief but intense exploration of retro gaming libraries just to bring me all the way back to Skyrim again. So I wanted to know from you, what are your guilty pleasures when you are not busy creating knowledge from thin air, and what about them draws you in?
How is Skyrim retro gaming?
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, I got two retro gaming handhelds and was legally downloading, of course, all the ROMs. Sure. From all kinds
of the ones that you own.
Yes, exactly. I was ripping them, you know, from all the consoles that I own, and like so that's what I've been doing. And I like briefly opened about, you know, two files, only to realize I really want to get back into Skyrim, and then just got like a modded Skyrim version, and then back to my
that's nice.
to my Steam Deck in the evenings, just you know.
But is it the new version? They did they recently published something new, right?
That was the Oblivion remastered. I'm still waiting. You know, I'm still waiting until there's a Steam sale of at least, you know, 70% on that. So that will be probably my next deep dive. But for now, it's like always. I just always keep coming back and then never finishing the main quest line and just maxing out on smithing and enchanting, and then not just being bored, just one-shotting everything on the map, and then having another, you know, half a year break just to start all over again.
Yeah, seems pretty much like my academic career. Yeah.
Maxing out on smithing and enchanting.
Yeah,
and
maxing, yeah.
Cheesing
a lot of side quests along the way.
Yeah, fuck the main quest.
Yeah, talking about guilty pleasures, retro gaming, I think, is also something right up my alley. I am on this very indie video streaming platform. You might not heard about it, but it's called YouTube.
Oh,
and
tell us more.
It's very, it's a great place to be. And there's a YouTuber called Majula, MAJULR, and he does a retrospective on the Ultima series from the late 80s, I think. And every individual game, he talks about like 3.5 hours about it, every detail, the development history, the entire game, every detail. But it's very chill. It's a very soothing voice. It's very nice to watch, and not watch, it's rather listening while cooking. So I would say that's a guilty pleasure of mine at the moment.
What's Ultima?
What's Ultima? I think that's one of the key role-playing video game series from the US. So it's not Japan, but the US. Google it. It's very pretty fundamental for role playing games.
Okay.
Came out of a yeah.
Interesting. Never. I don't know why I've not heard of. Maybe I've heard of it and I just.
We are too young. So I never played as a kid either.
What it is? What platform was that on?
PC.
Alex, fortunate enough, there's a 3.5 hour video.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm just watching a 226 episode long blind playthrough of Skyrim when I'm not playing Skyrim.
But Philip, like, honestly, when do you watch these videos? I mean, you mentioned
literally
cooking,
while I'm
then,
cooking.
I mean, how long are you cooking? Like
an hour,
3.5 hours.
45 minutes to an hour. How quick are you cooking?
I think I'm very efficient when it comes to cooking. It's like 15 minutes or so. But that's also why my kitchen is full of gadgets. 15.
Uncle Ben's.
No,
Uncle Ben's package rice is like 3 minutes in the microwave. So
And I'm already efficient, but it's my downtime. I enjoy cooking a lot. What's your guilty pleasure, Marco?
My guilty pleasure.
No escaping.
I try to though. My guilty pleasures. I think the most guilty pleasure-y thing is cycling. Not doing it, but also kind of nerding around it. So watching, first of all, listening to cycling podcasts by people we feel like they have an IQ of 15 or so, because every single sentence does not make a single sense to me, at least. Not because of their use of jargon, but kind of, I don't know, misplaced sayings and stuff like that. Yeah, so this is my downtime, and I really noticed that I need zero to non-IQ to follow. but then also, I have to admit,
just
especially
like
now
podcast.
With the Tour de France coming up, sometimes one of the three screens in front of me is... Yeah, showing cycling, and in the back you hear this very calming rotation of the helicopter.
sounds to fall asleep to.
Yeah, no, that's I think my guilty pleasure.
Because we had two video game suggestions, are there any cycling video games?
The Cycling Manager, yeah.
There really is? Oh my god.
Yeah. It's a very German thing, I think, as well.
Of course it is.
And I have to admit, the thing that I do over the winter, Swift, where you put your bike on this device that is basically translating your power input onto a video screen, is almost like a game. So you spend time riding your bike with friends online in a very... not beautifully animated world is also, I guess, the closest you can get to a cycling game, but it's quite fun, to be honest.
Pro Cycling Manager 25. Mostly positive.
Mostly positive. It's a cycling, I mean, oh my god. Well, we didn't manage. I tried to nudge Marco away from cycling, but apparently That is too guilty of a pleasure to avoid. So I will probably not put this stuff into the show notes of this episode. So you'll just have to take notes on that. I'm not sure how many YouTube channels are covering Ultima in 3.5 hour length, but I apologize in advance.
Quite a few.
But sorry. Well. Then, you know, just write Philip to his academic email address for the exact links and his most suggested episodes. with that out of the way, let's dive into the side content, the bonus content of this podcast, where we discuss a little bit about the trials and tribulations in academia as an assistant professor. Still, most of us are
still
most of us are, some of us are not, who knows, maybe some of us won't be by the time this airs. Philip, going to put you on the spot. What are we talking about today?
So I start with the topic of working in academia, and I have a question to you, or more something that I want to discuss with you. And this is working with your local faculty. So how much do you feel that your university pushes, incentivizes, and threatens to work with your colleagues directly at the faculty that you're at? How do you think about this? Do you feel that this is a pressure that is put onto you, or do you see a lot of opportunity for that? Or do you feel like the university that you're at is just a place to go to and a place that provides power to your computer, and beyond that, there's nothing to gain from it? How do you think about that, working with the faculty?
That's a really good question. If I may start, I actually asked my supervisor, or current now supervisor, whether this is something they do. And back then she said, it's not that people kind of wait for you now and you have to discontinue every project that you bring with you, because yeah, it's, as it turns out, nobody cared at all in a way.
And, nobody waited for you.
And I think this is something, at least for my the environment I was socialized in, it's quite different, because there it was given the German structure, an institute, and everyone worked together quite closely and also published together quite a lot. While over here, I think this is barely the case. And that's why I was kind of surprised at first. But now I started to appreciate and cherish it even, because, yeah, over the time, more or less organically, some ideas evolved and some did not. But I think that's totally fine. But to give you a conciser answer, I would say I don't feel any pressure, apart from pressure that I myself are making, because I also feel like it's a nice way of connecting and bonding with the people and getting to know them better. So I try to initiate some projects, and some of them, again, led nowhere, and some of them are hopefully becoming very prosperous and eventually well-cited publications. So, in this regard, I would say it is fruitful, but I guess you, in my case, I needed to be the one in a driving seat to actually start and engage or start with these ideas and publications.
That's interesting.
Yeah. How was it for?
It's interesting because, like, now the institution that I'm going to, I talked to a few people and they all told me actually it's actively disincentivized to work together with faculty. And it's not in the sense of that people tell you not to work together, but the way that your publication bonus is structured, you need to
just
share it.
School things.
Yeah. You need to share it if you co-author it with someone at the institute, but you don't if you co-author with somebody else. And that's like an explicit, you know, you're explicitly disincentivizing collaboration. And apparently, I mean, and this is just from talking to maybe two or three people, they said that actually happens, in the sense of that people that come to this institution tend to bring their own network and don't really... You know, that there's not a lot of university or departmental collaboration going on.
This.
Which is, I mean, a bit different to what Marco said, which is kind of this kind of German or Austrian system, where I'm not sure if how it was with you, but without even questioning, you know, this, whether this is okay or the integrity of this, it was like, I was told that my publication at this institute as a PhD needs to be done together with like one of the postdocs or one of the assistant professors plus the supervisor will also be on it. That's like, that's the way it is. And I didn't question it. And that was just, you know, the way it's done. And so you have, and I'm not sure, you know, I don't know. Like, I think I'm not sure what the better way to go about this is, you know, for from like a high level perspective as an institution, do you want to incentivize internal collaborations, or do you want to incentivize external collaborations, and what are like the, I'm not entirely sure if there's a, you know, if there's any blanket best practice.
I think for us in our the position that we are in, it would be most beneficial if we could work with senior faculty at our place, right? The feedback loops could be extremely quick. We are not coming from the same institution, so our thinking should not be completely alike, and we can collaborate in a fruitful way. So the best thing that we could do is build a good research collaboration with senior faculty at the places that we're at.
This is funny, because I would actually say the exact opposite.
Ah, why?
I think it's like when it comes to the time dimension, I think it's also good to rely on the network you're currently embedded in, because there,
Yeah,
you know,
fair.
people are reliable, you know, you're aware of their upsides and downsides, their capabilities and what they're not so good at. And in this regard, you're way faster in producing stuff.
Yeah, because you want to be careful. Like, this is, I feel like it's you quickly get into kind of situations where you create perverse incentives. Like, just an innocuous decision at the institution, I think at the VU even it's the same, but an innocuous decision to A, make publication bonuses attractive, so like make them high enough that it's actually attractive to see that as an extra income, and B, but at the same time, you know, say like, oh yeah, you'll have to share it if you do it with someone at your institution. This can have like a very strong repelling factor, actually, like where you really think about like, should I, you know, is it really worth for me to start looking for collaborators inside the institution, or should I really just be investing my effort outside, and vice versa as well. If you're incentivizing collaboration, that may quickly turn into, you know, a closed off institutions where people are just trying to, you know, get as many collaborations internally going, and you're locking out, you know, any incentive to go outside. So I think
I feel I'm a bit in a different situation. So I'm not even sure whether we have financial incentives for publications. Marco, do you know that? Do you have that?
We don't have that now.
Yeah, because I think we don't have it either. So that's a little bit out of the window.
Our financial incentive is that we're not getting fired. So
yes. Ding, ding, ding.
Or that you
financial
get,
stability.
Yeah. Or that you don't have get reduced teacher air research time.
Ah, okay, yeah. The whip instead of the carrot. Yeah, that,
yes,
that
yes.
Also.
Yes, yes. And for me, it was more a communication of to assess whether I'm a worthy person among the faculty. They would also look at whether I at least create a few collaborations. So I think they want to have at least with us a middle way where we have like one or two projects, also with PhDs at the faculty, to give a little bit back. And the bulk of the research collaboration should be obviously outside, but that's more like communicated. That's not incentivized, or there's no structure around it.
I mean, the incentive is kind of similar though, right? So I'm not there's still an incentive there. The incentive is a punishment instead of the reward. Like, you have to publish in order to, you know, have a, you know, not have to teach 15 courses. And so like, I wonder if that incentivizes also some direction of research. If, you know, maybe it's easier, like you said, maybe this incentivizes internal collaborations more. If, you know, Philip's assessment is correct, that it's kind of easier then to publish, you know, if you're working with colleagues within your department or institution, or if that pushes you to come in with an existing network and say, you know what, I need to do my publications, and honestly, I can't risk starting anything with people I don't know yet. I'm going to stick to my existing network, and kind of so yeah. I mean, it's the same incentive to publish more, right? Same pressure.
Yeah, that makes sense. Maybe beyond publications, how much is expected of you to be present during, I don't know, research seminars, brown bags, and so on and so forth? It's also collaboration, or to give feedback on internal seminars. Do you have a communication there?
Me, from what I heard, so where I'm coming from, there was a kind of a more research oriented strong culture of being in research seminars and having people present their work during the semester. Where I'm going to, I'll have to see, to be honest. I think it's more on the onus of the on your own kind of self to do that. I think that it's also difficult because of the teaching and where I am, where teaching is pretty structured. And so it's, I think, hard to find even times across a larger department where everybody can actually take place at take part in some kind of a seminar. That's my impression, is like, if you want to be part of an exchange, you kind of have to make the effort to do so. And if not, you're not going to be expected to show up to research seminars, my impression. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, for me or us personally speaking, I don't know. I think it's also about the benchmark you're setting yourself, or because as I'm around at the office most of the time, just like right now, people also expect you to be there. And I feel like for now it backfires in my spot, because if I'm not around, people are sort of confused and wonder. And,
is Marco okay? Is he dead?
Yeah, is he dead? But yeah, regardless of that, I think we recently had a very nice and interesting similar debate in this interdisciplinary group where I'm working, because there the meetings are almost empty. So I think it's a group. I know that it's a group of 20 people, and we meet once a month. And last time we were like the four of us, and the four of us being kind of the committee that is organizing the meetings. and this is, I think, really something that kind of sucks in a way. And then we were also discussing whether we should stop doing hybrid meetings, for instance, because even there you have two people online, and I don't know what they're doing, but they're certainly not actively engaging.
Skyrim,
we are watching 3.5 videos of some video games published in the 80s. But I think this was something that we were discussing for quite some time. So maybe also relating to that, how is this done at your current universities? So if you are there, do you need to be there physically, or could you also join virtually?
You can always join virtually, and we have quite a few seminars, so sometimes they're also overlapping, so it's somewhat expected that not everyone is there. But I think it's, yeah, but the variance is high. I would agree with you, if you tend to show up, people also start to expect you there a little bit. On the other hand, I know that some people, I've never seen them in any seminar, and they still exist, and it's also fine. I think it depends a little bit on how you want to be perceived and how you perceive your own role in the faculty. I want to be present because I think it's helpful for me to learn and also to attach social value to the work that we do, to see what other people do and give feedback.
That's a problem. I mean, I'm trying, let's the tying that kind of back to this original question with this, you know, do we collaborate internally, externally? I mean, it's also part of, it's so difficult, I think, to get this kind of thing going, because at my institute, for example, where I am now, you have this research seminar, which is pretty disciplinary, where you have people from, you know, theoretical economists to people that are steeped in kind of institutional theory and see like ASQ and AMJ as the outlets of choice. And you get these seminars sometimes where it just feels like such a waste of time, because only two people in the audience actually care or understand what's being talked about, and 80% are just frustrated to be there. And I still think, I'm still of the position that it's kind of a price you pay for serendipity, that you need to endure some you know, sessions, some interactions where you can't really put your finger on what the value of this is. But some of these sessions, you just come out and realize, like, I would not have taken part. I would not have met these people. I would not have talked to these people. I would have not engaged in this conversation if I wasn't, you know, quote unquote, forced to be there. And so I don't know, for these things to work, like hearing from what you've been saying, and I'm pretty sure it will be the same at every institution, it's, you kind of need someone senior in particular to just really force these kinds of things to happen, to make a strong stand and force people to come, because who shows up? Who shows up are the people with the highest incentive to search for connections, to search for, you know, exchange, and that tends to be juniors. And you know what, that doesn't really lead to much if you just have a room of the most junior people sitting together and basically talking about what happened last weekend. So I think these kinds of research seminars, or these cross-departmental or even within departmental regular research seminars, are probably something of a necessary thing to even get like internal collaborations going within departments and institutes. I don't think, or I don't know if it's a cause or an effect. You know, I don't know if it's kind of departments that are more cohesive, that are working more together, are also more motivated to do research seminars, or if it's, you know, doing research seminars gets departments to, you know, cross collaborate more. I don't know, but I'm very sure there's a very strong correlation when it comes to these things.
I think research seminars we have to explore, and it's own topic section. Let's maybe move on and
okay.
Who's next?
Who's next?
Alex, I pick you.
You pick me. Okay. A contentious topic, but that one that I have a pretty strong opinion on is why.
That's a surprise.
Yeah. Well, I usually don't have strong opinions. Why do we, as you know, organizational, behavioral, business, whatever you want to call yourself, researchers, have to write these managerial or policy implications in our papers? And I'm asking this because this may be totally naive from my part. I don't explore, you know, papers outside of my field that much. And I'm talking like really, you know, in medicine or in physics or chemistry, etc. I'm really talking outside. But my impression is that they don't have to do that. And I'm not just talking about natural sciences. I mean, I'd be surprised if you find, you know, implications for policy from, you know, history or language researchers. Maybe naive take, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here. And from my, I'm going to put my point out here. I think that's, I listened to, and I shared that episode with you from the This Is Research podcast, where Brad Greenwood and Yongjin Yu kind of duked it out about what's the ultimate winner, quantitative or qualitative research approaches. Spoilers, obviously quantitative. But I found myself agreeing with Jan's position that we are in no position to make these claims. We aren't policymakers. We aren't managers. We haven't seen usually an organization or any form of policymaking reality in years. Plus, which I also liked, is like no policy or you know, management decision should be based off of a single research finding. It should maybe contribute to, you know, a lot of evidence. But what we do is nearly never a basis for any kind of decision, but more of like a combination of results from our field should inform independently, you know, people that actually know about the realities. Long story short, I don't understand why we have to do this. I understand that the journals think that this is necessary to, you know, because I don't know what they think if some practitioner will actually read this, but I don't understand why we have to do this, why we have to spend the last day before submission asking ChatGPT what could be managerial recommendations.
Wow.
Hot takes only.
I would start just with a smaller point. This that I agree with. I think it's a format. So tying the results that you gained back to real life implications and considering how managers would translate that into behavior that could improve their firm or could improve whatever. It's just a format that translates the results into something else that has a broader implication. It is not that you, I think no one who writes these assumes that someone takes the result and then restructures the entire firm or kicks out the CEO based on that. But it is a way of discussing how this then relates back to the real world. And I think that's an extremely helpful and interesting exercise. And it ties it then back to discussions that are going on not in academia, but in among managers. So for me, it is usually board decisions. So what kind of a CEO do we want to have when, or what kind of a board structure do we prefer, and what kind of risk settings or whatever it is. And for me, it is an interesting exercise to go back to the. To this and to think through what my results could mean for this kind of decision making.
But that's not your job. That's not your expertise. You're not in a boardroom. You're a researcher. You know research methods. You know theory. You know literature. You get some data and you analyze it. You're not a
No,
manager.
I think that's a completely misunderstanding of management research. I think this if we do not understand the context that then we're in, we're not good researchers. I understand that we are not consultants, but if we cannot think through how this can, at least on a constructed situation, can affect decision making or should affect
decision making,
then no, I'm still here.
he blacked out his camera. I think then you're not doing your job right. Because I think that you put yourself in a position that is too far detached from the context that you should be interested in.
But that's what we have. That's, you just mentioned it. We're not consultants. That's what consultants are for. That's what journalists are for. That's what like people outside of our field reading our papers should do. I don't understand why we need
no,
to
a consultant,
be...
No, a consultant looks at one firm and tries to develop solution for the firm. And what the this is what it means for businesses, section of a paper means, in these kind of decision-making situations, please consider these results. And that's not the same as consulting. It's more pointing out if you run into these kind of contextual factors, please do consider what we looked at. And this is how you can consider it. And that's not consulting. But if you cannot do that for your own paper, then you do not know what you talk about, when I'm completely honest. Marco?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with both of you in parts. I think, like, overall, I think some of the fields you were referring to are just, like, different by nature. Like, looking into history, history is a subject in its own right, while we, as I guess managerial researchers, it was always kind of an application, right? So it's an application of sociology, psychology, tech studies, and so on and so forth. So I feel like we are in applied science, even though we tried, and I think that's also, we could also spin the argument the other way around, right? Why do we have to write theoretical implications? Because, yeah, we are also an applied science in a way, but we don't want to admit it. So I feel like we are in this limbus trying to talk to two audiences in a way. Having said that, I totally also get your point, Alex, that it's, I think sometimes it is artificial, and I'm not sure whether I would always argue that it is also meaningful, because if you write a conceptual paper, then you probably, like, yeah, writing then managerial implications might not be the smartest thing. And again, you can publish a broad array of stuff, right? So if you write a meta-analysis, I would assume that there are some practical implications to it. But if you write, yeah, again, a conceptual paper, yeah, why bother?
But also an empirical paper. And I mean, let's be honest here. How much time do you think that people like us are spending on the managerial and policy implications compared to the theoretical implications and the contributions?
Yeah, but this is like, only a function of what is appreciated in our field, right? If I would publish in AMJ with great managerial implications, I would spend way more time in writing and thinking about managerial implications, but I would not be able to publish there. That's why I'm spending more and more time on the theoretical implications.
See, I don't think that's true. Like, from everything I heard, this managerial policy implication part is just a dishonest exercise. And also to you know, jump maybe on the point that Philip made is like that we have to be experts and we have to understand how, you know, our research fits into, you know, the context of what you call the real world, which I would argue, I mean, are we living in are scholars not in the real world? Is our research not real? But generally, like, how much time have you spent in boardrooms in the last 3 weeks? How much time have you spent, like, leading or managing a company and understanding
the context? No, I'm just kidding. No, sorry. Yeah. Please continue.
So I'm like, interrupted you. Like, the fact of the matter is, to do the stuff we're doing and to do the research part of it, we're asked to read and to understand how to rigorously analyze, you know, data if we're empirical researchers, or to think a lot about what has been done before and how we build on research, on knowledge. And we don't spend time in the context. So I think it's extremely dishonest to say, you know, well, if we don't understand our context and be writing about this context, then we shouldn't be writing papers at all. Like, if it isn't super easy for us to write truthful, useful managerial or policy implications. The truth of the matter is we have no fucking idea.
Yeah, but we should have an idea, right? At least for this very specific topic. So if I know, like, in a field of OB, if I know that, I don't know, abusive leadership leads to higher turnover, then I should point it out. And I should write, hey, maybe look into kind of leadership programs that try to reduce abusive behaviors by supervisors, and if you want to keep your workforce.
Yeah, but isn't that bloody ridiculous as well? Like, you're doing a paper, right? Let's take your example. You're doing a paper where you're investigating abusive leadership, right? You're looking into this and you find that abusive leadership leads to turnover. And then your recommendation is, hey, managers, how about not being more abusive leaders? How about being more inclusive leaders? Here's my managerial recommendation. Two things. That is super lazy. And we probably spent, you know, 5 minutes just sitting down and thinking, like, how would non-academics be doing this? And two, it's so obvious. Like, anybody that reads even the introduction of this paper or just reads the results section, you don't even have to read the whole paper, can come up with that kind of a managerial implication.
Yeah, but an interesting managerial implication is not stop being abusive assholes. The implication is maybe to identify behavior, or through this study you identified behavior that is actually abusive, but usually not recognized as such. Something that you take out of it that is interesting for others. Obviously, it's not the, I mean, was not a good example because it feels so tautological, but what a good managerial
implication. But that is managerial implications in most, like, that's, I like Marco's example because literally that's what we see in papers, right?
Maybe that's the managerial example. I recently talked to a group of senior executives and told them about Philip's paper. And there I introduced them to this idea of mental models. And to them it was like, this is why I have a hard time working together with consultants, because they have a completely different understanding of the world. And I mean, they are in their 50s and 60s, and I thought I'd talk to my bachelor students. But to them, it was super enlightening because they have a different perspective on things. And I think that is a managerial implication in a way, if you frame it in the right way.
But isn't that, that's what I'm saying, is like, that's also something that comes out in a discussion or a results section. I don't understand why we have to put in a policy or managerial recommendation for my paper.
Discussion and results section. They are not able to.
People don't read the managerial implications.
I wouldn't say so. Especially more journals put it at the very top. Something that SMJ, you can even access without buying the paper, quote unquote.
Yeah. So, Alex, I think your argument rests on two assumptions that I struggle with. The first one is you see theoretical contribution and managerial contribution as something fundamentally different, and getting one thing might be even contradictory to the other. And I disagree with this wholeheartedly. I think a good managerial implication is a translated theoretical implication. So that there's not, if you do it well, if you have an interesting question and an interesting theory, then you should not even have a contradiction there. It's more of a way of translating it. And the second thing is that you complain about very bad managerial implications written, where you just try to dumb it down a little bit and try to write it a little bit fluffy. That's also not what we argue for, right? Obviously, it's not, we do not want to rely on the poorest example of the bunch. But I think if you think about it like that, that you try to translate the interesting theory contribution that you do towards a more applied perspective, then I think you already have way more leeway there to also have an interesting point. And the second thing is look for interesting managerial implications, and there are quite a few out there. They also provide interesting examples.
Looking at the third assumption, we don't know shit about the real world or the not so real world. I completely agree with you. And there, I feel like, and sometimes if you read this, these managerial applications, they are quite paternalizing in a way. So they're really, and I think there we just need to be humble and provide some suggestions that would be, that are based on our data, and sometimes they might help.
I mean, I just want to clarify. I don't think in general that I don't have that assumption that these are two separate things, not at all. I don't think that's how I'm talking about it. I think it's more of a case that it's, look, if we have an incentive to write proper, useful managerial incentives that managers are actually interested in reading, and we have an incentive to do so, I think we would have the capabilities to do so, is what I'm getting at. But at the moment, it's just something that we have to tack on. It's treated as such most of the time. And the fact of the matter is, I challenge you to find me any, you know, like a handful of actual practicing managers or policymakers that read academic journals. There is something they read which has managerial implications, and those are called things like Sloan Review or Harvard Business Review, where they don't do it that much anymore, but their role was to do exactly that. Look, this is an interesting piece of scientific research here. We'll give you space to really like expand upon this. Talk to managers, test this, you know, test if what you find in this paper is actually applicable to the quote unquote real world. I just don't think that as it is right now, managerial implications as a paragraph after theoretical contributions is fulfilling any purpose, and anybody is taking it seriously. And thus, it's just a frustrating exercise for us because, you know, we won't be taking it seriously. Nobody takes it seriously because we're not incentivized to do so. And so we end up with these, you know, paragraphs, which are honestly most of the time, like the example that Marco just gave, is like, look, we found bad behavior is bad, and here is the numerical results. Thus, managers, how about you don't do the bad behavior anymore in your big company?
Would you say that this still serves the purpose that... If you are, I don't know, an HR executive, that you can actually quantify what you try to say. So I found research backing up what we actually observe in our, I don't know, exit interviews, for instance.
I don't know if that's being done. I don't know if that's truly being done. And also, I don't know if you really need us to spell out the results as managerial implications. Like, I don't know how hard of an exercise it would be. Like, I have to be careful in the sense of like this idea of that we have to translate stuff for managers or policymakers. I think most people, if they're interested, they can look at results at the, not the, maybe not even the results section, but a good, you know, condensation that we have to put into introductions and into our discussion section where it says, look, we found this went up, this went down, this didn't do anything. And then they can make their own managerial implications. They don't need us as some higher power to explain to them, look, if this thing goes down, this is what it means for your generic company. And this is in like a paragraph. It would be entirely a different exercise if we were writing for these practitioner facing journals, like where we had to, where we had more than one or two, you know, paragraphs, and we actually supplement our empirical findings with, you know, talking to actual managers and asking them, like, look, is this something you found as well? And like, how have you tackled this?
I want to offer one more angle where I think it provides value. So if I read the paper, the managerial implication allows me as an academic reader to look at the results yet again from a different angle, right? So this allows me maybe to maybe also understand them better and offers me ways to implement that into my teaching, to implement that into conversations that I have with practitioners. So maybe it is also not truly aimed at practitioners, but it is aimed at academics that informs them how this might relate to their executive teaching, to their graduate teaching, or to stuff that is going on in the real world, quote unquote. and that's one advantage. And the other advantage that it allows the authors to think through their results from a different angle. And I think there's value in it. Maybe I would agree with the notion that this value is underutilized. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the result from that should be to abolish it or to get rid of it. It's more let's do better ones and have a conversation of what makes a good managerial implication or policy implication. To be honest, I have very little experience with. But what makes a good managerial implication, and have more of a discussion as a field about how we can do that.
I don't know. I still think this is like, if you want to do it really well, like if you really want to make meaningful, like really something that is meaningful to managers that they can look at and really understand, I think there is space and there should be outlets where this is an extra exercise, because I just don't see how our managerial implications can be anywhere close as rigorous to our empirical or our contributions to theory unless we spend, you know, time actually engaging with this, with a context, and really using that as well to really provide empirical
managerial. Like that? Okay.
But yeah.
One last thought. Looking at the many projects of my PhD that all kind of linger around and don't go anywhere, the ones that really don't go anywhere are the ones that where I could not answer the question in a sensible way, what would be a managerial implication? And the ones that I think that are progressing faster, the ones that I find interesting, the ones that I can make people interested in, are the ones where I can also make an interesting case of why it could be relevant for practitioners to know that. So being able to formulate an interesting managerial implication is also maybe just a function of, is it interesting research, yes or not? And I think maybe that's the exercise that we should go through, that we should sit down and think it through. And if it doesn't click, and if we can't even come up with a damn story where we can tell, imagine us being at a party, meeting one of our consultancy friends again, and trying to tell them what we are doing and make it interesting to them. And if we're unable to do so, maybe the research question is not that interesting.
Well, I guess so. I mean, I'm gonna stick to my opinion that
I was not expecting to convince you.
We should just stop pretending like we can actually do this in a meaningful way. But I think
maybe we should just get better at understanding the context that we work on.
That's also an implication for sure. But I don't want more work. I want less work. Well, so.
Alex, let's start a podcast. Ethnography.
You know, if my family gets taken hostage and they are held at gunpoint by you, Marco, and said they will only be freed if you do an ethnography, I'll probably
think
about it.
Live again?
Depends on the part of the family.
Thanks.
We'll keep you updated about that. We still got an entire topic, as usual. Marco, I believe you have a last topic surprise, that I don't know really what it's about.
Just kidding. it also relates to your topic, Philip, as well, because I was wondering whether you have, as an academic, again, you have to resettle in quite many ways, and most likely not only once but twice. And what I noticed also talking to more senior academics that moved on quite a lot of times is that you always kind of lose some roots in a way, and you have to start building new social ties later on. And while this has been discussed now for the academic realm, I was wondering how you do stuff like that in a private realm. So I don't know, you come to a new city, in your case, Alex, it will be Barcelona. In your case, Philip, it was Utrecht. How do you spread your wings and fly? Or how do you find people to hang out with?
Yeah, so I think the worst thing is that what everyone says is true, and this is that you need to do stuff that you like, and through hobbies you get friends, and you have to ask people whether they want to hang out with you, which feels weird, but if you do that, you get to know people, and then you need to invite them a few times and have beers with them, and you need to expect to hang out with people that you might not have hung out with in your hometown or in the place that you used to live before. But if you go through that process and have some confidence in it, and 8 months or 9 months later, you have a small friend circle again, and having some trust in that helps.
I wanna,
that it will work out yet again.
I want to ask like a follow-up question. Like, how, in your opinion, how do you value, you know, new friendships or new social ties versus, you know, fostering your old friends? Because that's something that I, you know, with this kind of question, I had the same when coming here. I made kind of a conscious decision to just ignore everybody that is here where I am. And just put all my effort in making sure that the friends that have been with me for a long time, I don't, you know, neglect them, because I felt like I can't do both. I can't, you know, take care.
I think that's a very unhealthy thing, to be honest. For me personally, it would be very unhealthy. I need local contacts, and only if it's a few. And now I have one person for running and cycling. I have Marco.
Yeah, well, that's unfair. I mean, that's just that you have the...
Yeah, but we also only see us not that often.
But that's so basically, you've got two.
Marco's also traveling more than I am home. So, no, that doesn't make sense. But he's traveling a lot. And I'm home more. So, yeah. And I have one person for talking and music, and the other person is for running and cycling. And I have Marco. And that's extremely important. And it's the only thing that gives me a feeling of home here, that okay. I have people that I could reach out to.
Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't see that much of a tension there with contact with friends. I mean, there's some tension, but not too much. There's almost no cost involved with meeting a friend locally once a week for a beer and then meeting another friend on the weekend. It's like in total 6 hours or what.
And yeah, you but still, I totally get also Alex's point. I mean, okay. That was.
But it gives you the feeling of being local.
There is some tension, I think, because you cannot, I mean, you can only have so many social ties in a way. And it, I guess also our time and our mental capacity are sort of limited, right?
I think so. Because that was my, I'm not saying it was the right decision. I might have made the wrong decision, but my decision was like, I want to cherish the people that have been in my life through this time, and also having moved around a lot. And I want to make sure that the capacity and time I have for social contact is really prioritizing my old friends, even if this means that locally I don't have anybody, to be honest. And I know that vice versa, I have lost a lot of old friends, for better or for worse, I don't know, where when I have moved somewhere else and done the flip, kind of like when I moved to Vienna, I decided like, look, I want to reconnect with my local friends. And this just means like, I might at best be able to keep up with one or two people that are not in my, you know, local vicinity. And that's basically exactly what happened. I've got like, you know, I lost all contact to my friends from abroad, apart from two people. And yeah, I think that's, I do think there is a tension there. It depends on like, I also think it depends on the structure of your social circle, right? If you've got one best friend or two best friends that stick to you, you know, no matter what, I don't think there's a lot of tension because, you know, you'll find time, you know, whenever, every few weeks to catch up. But if you've got like a friend.
But how much value do you attribute to, I only know German term, acquaintances would be in English term, Bekannte, that you just hang out with from time to time? How much value do you derive from that, to being able to call someone, hey, do you want to grab a beer?
I think I don't need that at all. Like I thought I do not like having acquaintances, and I get nothing from acquaintances. Like it's a waste of time, and I get all my
energy.
That's
a very easy way to get friends. Just go to them and tell them I get nothing from
that's
you.
Literally how
the incentives are stacked against you.
I will piece you of will shit. Forget about me within 5 minutes after I've left this country. But that was truly like, I felt like all I need is good, true connections, even from abroad, and I get nothing from acquaintances. And it turns out I think I might have miscalculated because I'm pretty damn lonely here. Like lonely in a way where this can't be fulfilled by, you know, having regular calls or even online, you know, meetings with my friends away. And it's a thing where I'm wondering now, like, hey, I think I shouldn't do this anymore. Like, even if it's frustrating, and to even know that probably these people you meet now and that you go out for a beer, as soon as you, you know, change to another job, they won't be in your life again. But I'm wondering if my like kind of cynical view of just saying, well, what's the point of putting any effort into this in the first place is misplaced. Because I do think that kind of backfired a little bit for me, and really taking this radical, you know, I don't want to waste quote unquote time on acquaintances. I want to put all my time into
but
my.
To be fair, I think if I would have been in your shoes, network. I would act pretty much the same. As
I mean, you have always
had this kind of temporal lens to it, right? So it was not permanent, and I think in this regard, again. Philip mentioned it already, right? So it takes 7, 8, 9 months, or at least for me, it took, I guess, a year or so, where I could like develop at least some social ties. And I think I would not have bought it at all if it would be for 1 or 2 years.
And maybe I think I would have still tried to get like 1 or 2 friends outside of university where we can have conversations beyond publication.
Why?
Processes and faculty gossip.
Why would you do this to yourself?
Why? What do you talk about them? There's no value.
No. Where's the value? Where's the publication
about,
in that?
Managerial implications. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I used to do that, and probably you did as well when you were in semesters abroad or when you did a master's degree and stuff. I mean, that wasn't a perspective one had.
Yeah, everyone's in the same shoes.
Yeah,
and
yeah, but that's different.
Like,
yeah,
going
sure
out
you are
so
very
regular,
different.
And everyone's kind of open to meet new people. Because just like with to building ties within the faculty, I felt like nobody would be out open to go out for a beer because they're already settled, they live their lives, and it's not the same.
Yeah.
And I have to be honest here, I was sort of naive in this regard. because I thought it would be pretty much the same, and it turned out it was not the same at all.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, so, I mean, that was a detour from your question, but I guess, at least from my learning now, what I do is, like, I'd also follow Philip's recommendation as you know, as obvious as it is, but kind of do stuff you like with people that are there.
Just go to a magic tournament,
exactly,
right?
Yeah.
Local one.
That's something, so like getting into like more social nerd hobbies beyond Skyrim, and that I can actually do in person, and just, you know, talking to people, and not seeing this as another kind of transitionary period where it's not worth to invest a single, you know, iota of effort, because, you know, what's the point of acquaintances?
Well, for our listeners, we are three new friends.
I mean, friends is a bit strong.
Acquaintances.
That's acquaintances.
There's no value. There's no value
I'm never gonna
in talking to
you.
You're weak.
I'm never going to play Cycling Manager. What's Marco ever going to talk to me about?
Magic Manager.
No, yes, we are. We're not new friends. Kind of new.
Who?
We're not three. You said we're three new friends.
Yeah. That is. No, what? Who? Sorry. For our listeners.
Yes, exactly.
I was trying to wrap up the episode and wanted to set up a stage. But do you have another segment coming up?
Oh, Alex? Yes. Thank you for reminding me. Now that we come to the end of the segment, another bonus content that you've all been waiting for is today's episode, being brought to you by Home Appliances. And you thought that distinguishing between ChatGPT-03 and ChatGPT-40 is a pain in the ass? Try figuring out whether the Samsung Smart RB34C602DSA/EF or the Samsung Smart RB38C605DS9/EF will keep your cottage cheese sufficiently cool. As a matter of fact, there are currently 121 fridge models in MediaMarkt Spain, and the naming conventions are really giving me panic attacks. And I'm generally always against government overreach and overregulation, but I will fully support including more than two digits in any kitchen appliance's name as a criminal offense. So send LG and Samsung and Bosch and whoever else customer support emails only containing the subject line desk reject to return them the favor. And that's my...
That would then refer to our prior podcast.
Exactly. And then they will have to listen to our podcast and we get more listeners and we'll get more managerial, you know, our managerial implications will get better because we'll get invited to all these companies to, you know, help them design their
product.
And you
will find some acquaintances there.
And I will get new friends in Korea and China and everybody's happy. Especially me.
Great.
And I'll get a free new fridge, which is basically the whole thing why I did this.
So you prefer the IKEA approach of Billy on Bongo and Blim Blums?
Yeah, honestly, compared to RB38C605DS9/EF, I would prefer my fridge to have a Swedish.
That's still a number. I think the number is essential because there are now several editions of a PAX, for instance, and you never know which PAX it is. So,
yeah.
Oh, it makes a difference.
Do you really
like, honestly,
have to know?
Like, last advice before we close this episode.
Oh, it
the
makes
new
a difference.
PAX models are insane because you can build a kind of, yeah, build them up by yourself. You don't need a second person if you don't have an acquaintance like me. So I could do it all by myself. No acquaintances needed.
Once again. But there you go. Why would you get a previous PAX? Why does it need models? What's the reason for you to get a PAX 2 compared
because
to a PAX 4 I, for example? Anyway. All right. That's a good point. I forgot. Yeah. I forgot that we're poor. And and to not make you suffer any longer, thank you very much for listening. Currently, as before and as in perpetuity, you will not be able to follow us on much of the socials unless we get a grant, and this won't change probably. If you do like our podcasts, go hit subscribe on Spotify, on Overcast, on Pocket Cast, on Apple Podcasts, and any app that has cast as their last letter. You know what? I'm pretty sure on most of the Samsung fridges, you can now download your podcast player of choice. So also subscribe your grandparents and parents on their fridge and get them all the newest episodes on time. They love it. Intro and outro music and ad music is by Blue Dot Sessions. This episode was probably produced by me, Alexander Staub, until
we don't know that.
We don't know that. We won't know. Maybe an AI will produce it by the time I get around to it. All right. Bye bye, everybody.
Goed doei.
So.